Welcome to the Coach Dave Love Podcast with NBA shooting coach Dave Love and your host, Matt Robertson. Exploring the cutting edge of evidence-based shooting development in basketball today. From shooting form to skill acquisition to shot metrics. This is the Coach Dave Love Podcast.
Welcome to the Coach Dave Love Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Robertson, and with me, as always, is the man of the hour, NBA shooting coach Dave Love. Dave, what's going on?
Hi, Matt. my tone is for a reason, and the reason being that this is take two. I forgot to plug in my Ethernet cable, and I'm in 2024, just like the rest of the people. And but somehow my internet isn't always in 2024. Sometimes it reverts back to 2012 or somewhere in that range, and I lost my signal. So we're starting again, and I'm gonna make you make a joke that you made in our pre-show preamble that you made in take one. Made me laugh both times. And so how are you feeling, Matt?
Okay, I'll try to switch up the delivery because that this will really see what I got going on here. So Dave, I don't know if you know this, but I've been feeling a little under the weather. This is day four or five.
I'm devastated to hear this.
Yeah. But I'm on the tail end. I'm on the upswing. So it definitely isn't the Michael Jordan flu game because that is like peak. You know, that would have been 2 days ago and just would have been untenable. However, this could be Scottie Pippen's migraine game. And I may ask out of the podcast at about the 30-minute mark. Not funny the third time.
I mean, I'm laughing on the inside, but and you got a hearty laugh from me the first time when it was organic. You got a good chuckle from me the second time when we tried to pretend it was organic, and the third time I don't have the acting chops to.
There it is.
It's on me. It's not on you.
We found the misser, the weak link in the armor of your armor. Just, you're not a good actor. That's the not concise, not a good actor. And otherwise just the armor remains intact. So I'll forgive you this one. I got the audio episode, the infamous audio episode of, what is a shooting consultant. So you get the Ethernet, cable of episode 15 or whatever this one is.
There we go. So I started to tell you before we got rudely interrupted that, I had somebody, I was in Dallas last week and I had one of our video coordinators come up to me and say, hey Dave, love the podcast. And then I had to check with you because I told him, oh, well, have you heard that you were referenced in one of the podcasts? And then I had to check with you, whether that was in fact true. So the video coordinator, / player development coach is a guy by the name, I almost said fella again, a guy by the name of, is that something I say a lot?
What up, fella? What up, guy?
So this is Max Hooper in player development / video for the Dallas Mavericks. And you confirmed that we had, in fact, referenced Max in a previous episode.
Yeah, so the salesy part of me remembered his name and connected it to the million threes that he shot in college. It was the episode that was just you and I talking about off-season shooting planning. And I said, I've got two things, and one I don't want to forget. And you said, what's the second thing? And I didn't know what you were talking about. And then remembered, we were talking about Jack Gultke, who hit almost 20 threes in 2 games of the NCAA tournament. And you, he had shot 93% of his shots or 95% of his shots were threes this season. And you said, ah, well, I know a guy. Yeah. Max Super. Go ahead.
Well, and Max, I mean, that's just one of the great things about Max, who I hope will end up listening to this episode like 3 months from now. And we'll for a second time, we'll hear us talking about him because he has one of the great basketball names of all. And maybe I said this last time because I repeat jokes often. much like a dad should. And like Max Hooper, give me a better basketball name than Max Hooper. Come on.
One of the real ones. One of the real ones.
Yeah. So anyhow, shout out to Max Hooper. So, okay. We saved this for the podcast. Let's get through this very, very quickly because today is April 8th, which might not make any sense to anybody listening in May. But if you're listening on April 9th, there was a significant event that occurred on April 8th, and you got to be in a part of the world where it was at its peak. Tell me about this solar eclipse, Matt.
Yeah, so I live in Moncton, New Brunswick, in the middle of nowhere. For all of you Americans listening, you go Maine and you go north and east until you cannot go north and east anymore, and that is where I live. We were in the path of the eclipse, and the town that I live in was within 0.11 of total coverage, or totality, I guess they call it. So we drove like 40 minutes north to go sit in this like school playground with my wife of the stiff high five and her sister and her family. She's got a bunch of kids, and watch the eclipse happen. And was cool. You get your weird little $3 glasses, your 3D glasses from the movie theater, and you look up at the sun and you see the silhouette of the moon kind of creeping over, which was neat. But whatever, you know, fine. However, when it got close to total coverage, it got cold, and it's been a beautiful day up here. It's been somewhere close to 50 degrees, which for here is quite warm, unseasonably warm this time of year. And the wind picked up and it got cold, and really quickly it was like nighttime. So you had kind of red sky on the horizon in one direction, and you could still kind of see light a little bit off in the distance, but it was getting quite dark in the immediate vicinity. And then at one point the sun was totally covered and you could see just a black ball with a yellow circle around it. And there must've been a solar flare at about 7 o'clock, cause you could see one red little dot, which was pretty cool. And in the lead up to that, it felt like in the movie Twister, whatever filter they shot that with, it was ominous. It was getting a little bit dark, a little still. Yeah, a bit of a surreal experience. So you had texted me a little earlier, been like, maybe a womp womp experience for people near Dallas where that was. But for us, like, it was pretty significant. Kind of I wouldn't have drove, 10 hours to Niagara Falls or whatever. It was a really cool experience.
Yeah, so I'm old enough that there was a near, I don't know the percentage, but a near total solar eclipse, I think in like 1978. So I was like 3 or 4, pre-kindergarten, but like preschool. And I can still remember walking to preschool with my mom and being like, it's like nighttime, but it's 11 o'clock in the morning. And I still wondered, like, is my perception of that accurate, or have I tainted that perception through many, 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 many years of age? And so anyways, I feel like we've spent the required 2.5 minutes on the solar eclipse. And maybe people want us to move back to basketball talk.
I will say really quickly, just to make you feel a kind of way, my dad also remembers that eclipse. Thanks. Although he's, no problem. He's a little, I think he was in later stages of high school. So, a little ways away, maybe he was 18, 19 or 20, somewhere in there. But he said the same kind of thing. So yeah, I think your recollections are closer, which is just your memory spot on, regardless of the years, the memory is spot on.
Yeah. Everybody knows 3.5-year-old or 4.5-year-old Dave Love was pretty in tune.
He's advanced, right? Just like my kid, advanced.
Yeah. All right. So today is a you and I kind of a duo episode. What are we calling this?
Sure. Sure. Team. Team.
We're going to workshop it. But working title, duo team podcast. And our topic I've chosen. We did one that people seem to really want about why do players miss left And so I want to dive into another kind of common miss and talk about why do players have flat shots and what can they do about it? So how do you feel?
I feel great. There's a couple of players that stick in my head with this. I'm going to save, I think, my questions about them till the end so I don't step on any of your toes. So why don't we jump right in and we'll get to those kind of closer to the end.
All right. I love it. So I want to start with a common misconception that I hear from players who I feel are just regurgitating what a coach has taught them or told them, or the coaches that they may not have shooting as a focus and they're just trying to give some advice. When a lot of people see a flat shot, the first thing they go to is you need more legs. And I find in my experience, that's rarely the reason for a flat shot. That of all the possible causes, that's probably realistically towards the bottom. So I'm not saying it's not possible. I'm not saying that. It is possible, but it's usually not the reason in my experience. So instead, what I want to do and what we're going to talk about a lot through this episode is going to be where I think the problem tends to occur, being players end up out of position at the set point. Ooh. and make mistakes that cause flat shots because of being out of position at that set point.
That comment is going to make frequent listener Mitch very happy. Shout out, Mitch. Often when we see this in the gym, whoever's watching just yells, just get it up. Just get it up. Like it's the simplest thing in the world to just reproduce, you know, just get it up. It's one of my favorite things, actually.
So let's make sure at the end of the episode, if we can, that we remember, if you can make a note, to talk about differential learning around getting more arc on the shot. So I'll excuse you if you look down or feverishly type really loudly. I laughed at myself as I was waiting for you to come into the studio here. I started typing. I could see that my little VU meter for my mic was working pretty hard, but this is a callback to an episode about three episodes ago, I think. So, before we get too far into the causes, I do want to make sure that we talk about how do you know? Because I think it's hard for a lot of players to know that they have a flat shot because where they are standing as a player shooting a basketball is about the worst spot that you could stand to judge the arc of your own shot. In reality, the worst place that you could stand is directly under the apex. And players aren't that far removed for that. So it's really tough for somebody to tell for themselves that they have a flat shot. And so one of the things I'd encourage people to look for is, do you hit the front rim a lot? If you hit the front rim a lot, it's not that you aren't shooting it far enough. More often than not, you're just not getting the ball high enough to clear the front rim before it gets to your intended distance, that the bottom of the ball hits the front of the rim on its way there.
Can you treat me just for a minute like a junior high coach? And I've seen you do this really great thing when you're doing clinics, talking about eye level of the hoop, or sorry, visible level of the hoop as the ball's coming towards it. Sorry, I just did a thing on the camera that if you're listening to Spotify or Apple Podcasts doesn't make any sense. Can you describe ideal arc for me just for a minute? And can we also, as a tangent to that, talk about NOAA just for a minute also?
Yeah. So NOAA does a great job. They have on their website, which I think might be NOAA Basketball, but don't quote me on that. NOAA is a company that has a product that measures the arc of shots. They've done a lot of research because they have millions of shots to measure. They've done a lot of research that says, you know, around 45 degree entry angle, the ball entering the hoop is the ideal arc. And the reason for that is that gives the maximum amount of surface area for the ball to clear the front rim, but get down before the back rim, while also hitting the sweet spot of controllable distance. The higher that you shoot the basketball, and I think we've referenced this in a different podcast as well, the higher you shoot the basketball, the harder it is to control the distance. And so that 45 degrees gives you the maximum surface area, while also giving the best distance control. So the example that I think you might be referencing, and I encourage coaches to do this, because even my explanation now, some people might be going, what the heck is this guy talking about? the great example is, I'll get players to lay on the floor around free throw line distance on one part of the circle, like make a circle around center court, free throw line distance and sideline distance. So a big circle. And lay on their stomach with their head pointing towards center court. And then I'll instruct them to imagine that the jump circle in the middle of the court is the hoop. And I'll ask them, like, what shape do you see? We know this is a jump circle. It's circular. But from the angle that you're looking at, if you imagine that your head is the basketball, do you see a circle or do you see a really skinny oval? And the kids will all say, well, no, I see a skinny, skinny oval. And you say, okay, well, if the hoop were this big, and I usually stretch my arms out, so I've got about a 6-foot wingspan, the jump circle is about, I think it's 12 feet. But anyway, the proportions would be about the same to say, like, if the jump circle's the hoop, the basketball would be about this big, and I've got my arms stretched out. And I say, if the ball were traveling at the angle that you're looking at right now, where your head is just barely above the floor, could you fit the basketball through the opening that you see? And the answer is obviously no. You've got a tiny sliver of an oval and a basketball that's far wider than that opening. Then I'll instruct the kids, get up on your knees. And so they get onto their knees and they say, okay, now, whoever shot your head, which we're pretending is a basketball, do they shot the ball a little bit higher, they shot your head higher. Do you see a bigger opening or a smaller opening? And they all say it's bigger. Could you fit the basketball through that opening? And they all kind of hum and, I'm not sure. And you go, yeah, it's getting close now, but we probably have to be really perfect and now stand up. And so now there's more arc on the basketball, the imaginary basketball, and they can see more surface area to fit the ball through. And I actually haven't done that in a clinic in a number of years. But thank you for the reminder of that. I think it's a good little teaching point because it's such an abstract concept for a 13-year-old kid to kind of understand.
Totally makes it real for them. I really think it's valuable. I've watched you do it a number of times, again, more than 5 years ago, probably, which kind of gives a frame of reference for how long it's been. But I wanted to give you to give that because from an ideal arc perspective, really hard to know what is ideal. And it's interesting that you say, because I didn't know, when the NOAA calls out the arc, it gives you the entry angle. And I didn't know that. I always thought it was the angle that I released it at.
Right. Go ahead. What was your question?
How do you know what the ideal release angle is? And you have an answer for this, I think.
Well, not a clean one, because the nice thing about part of the reason why NOAA uses the entry angle is it's universal. And then part of it will be because that's the easy one to measure given where they put their cameras. Okay. The unfortunate part is what players control is what I call launch angle. And the launch angle will vary depending on the distance that the shot is taken from and the height that the ball is released from in order to create that 45 degree entry angle. So I would want to try and coach to players more towards what they control, which is the launch angle, which then causes the entry angle, but the launch angle is going to be different for different heights of players shooting from different distances. So there's no one universal answer, and the math is beyond my I sort of have a website that I reference if I need to get specific for the research that I'm doing. Like if somebody's releasing from 23 feet 9 inches and their release is 8'6" off the ground, what speed does that need to be? I think it's about 29 feet per second. And
I'll take your word for it.
at what angle? And I think it's about 48, but then if the entry, it gets complicated. So
that makes me think about, again, this could be a whole tangent. I don't want to derail the conversation. This is interesting. When I watch Kawhi Leonard shoot the basketball, when he's shooting a wide open jumper, and he's not really, he's jumping maybe 7, 8, 9 inches off the ground, just comfortable. However, if you go back to the shot, apologies to the city of Philadelphia, in that playoff series, and you look at the zoomed out shot of him from the side, he's elevated like 3.5 feet off the ground. So that launch angle and that launch height has changed. That gives me a whole other perspective for that, and which I'd never really considered before. I mean, we've talked about this topic a couple of times in off the air. Just gives me some perspective that I'd never thought about before. It's very cool.
Yeah, and again, we should come back to differential learning, because what you just described is the reason that concepts like differential learning will be so important, and why a poop ton of block practice might actually be teaching people to be less accidentally teaching people to be less adaptable. And since we had Phil Begner on, who I think he gave the lowest level of curse word that you could possibly give. I forget what he said exactly, but I cracked up and you made a comment about it. I went,
he said crap.
Crap?
Yeah, he said crap. Okay. Yeah.
So I'm borderline going to have to put an explicit tag on this podcast, but I think we're safe with poop ton.
I was going to say, we're going to go for a real quick break. And after we do our ATO, I'm going to probably send you a new set of lines for the salty language. So let's go for a quick break.
Hey there, basketball fans. I'm NBA shooting coach Dave Love, and I've got exciting news just for you. Introducing my exclusive free basketball shooting newsletter. It's packed with insights and techniques straight from the hardwood. Have you ever wondered how NBA players improve their shots? Or how you could get to the next level, whether you're a college player, a coach, or a budding youth player? My newsletter brings all this and more directly to your inbox. Each edition is a deep dive into the world of basketball shooting. I'll share some of the tips and ideas that I use with my NBA clients, tailored for every level of the game. But wait, there's more. Subscribers receive exclusive monthly discounts on my online products. From training videos to personalized coaching sessions, you'll get it all for a fraction of the price. And the best part of all, it's absolutely free to join. So what are you waiting for? Elevate your game and join a community of passionate players and coaches from around.
All right, welcome back. So if you're familiar with the pod, if you listened to the last episode, we've started this, I don't want to call it a gimmick, but let's call it a gimmick. This is an ATO, an after timeout, where coach draws up a play, the boys execute, or the girls, actually, in the spirit of the women's championship game last night, let's say the ladies execute, and we get a bucket out of it.
Flawlessly.
Flawless execution, 2 points for coach. We're going to put 24 seconds up on the thought clock, and Dave, give me the topic that we just discussed concisely, please.
We're discussing how players get flat shots. I think rather than this being a gimmick, this is a shtick And then the thank you. Oh shoot, I'm running out of time on the shot clock. And you will know that you have a flat shot if your most common miss hits front rim.
Awesome. So you worked in a joke into the set. So you, it was a bit of a misdirection. So I applaud that. Really good effort.
Not sure Dave, it was a good joke, but okay. No,
listen, constraints. I put a constraint on you and you executed with degrees of isolation. I'm learning so much. Dave, can you jump into the causes of the flat shot? So not just the typical need more legs, which is something that sort of us, maybe, you know, myself, I'll speak for myself in terms of being relatively uneducated. That's what we would say. Need more legs. Get it. Just get it up. So talk about the causes a little bit.
So the first thing that I end up seeing is most players, they struggle with a flat shot because their hand ends up on the wrong part of the basketball. I've said this before, and I'll continue to say it throughout numerous episodes. Shooting a basketball is similar to billiards. This is just simple physics. The ball goes in the opposite direction of where you apply force. And so if you apply, if you're getting a flat shot, if the ball is going too much forward and not enough up, then you are probably pushing the back of the ball too much. Hmm. And so one of the things that there's really two ways that this happens. Young players end up having a set point below their chin, where it makes it really difficult for them to get their hand underneath the basketball. And so their hand ends up more on the back of the ball. Or if you end up getting the ball to a set point sort of around your nose or over top of your nose, you have room to get your hand underneath the basketball, but you might not bend your wrist back. And so your hand ends up more on the back of the basketball at that point. And so the most common, and I would say by a lot, cause of having a flat shot is getting your hand on the back of the basketball at what is your set point.
Do you think that's a product of how the player has learned kind of growing up? Or do you think that that's a product of the physical having difficulty, whether it's a risk flexibility issue or like, where do you think that comes from?
I would be willing to bet almost all of us, it starts with physical strength. That at a young age, we all grow up and the basketball is really heavy and we're trying to probably shoot from far out because it's fun. And so we're not strong enough to get both arc and distance, and we really want to get distance because that's so much fun. The one time out of 20 that goes in, so we sacrifice arc to get it. And these aren't conscious decisions by 12-year-old Sammy. This is just his body figuring out, how do I get the ball from here to there? And he's seeing that, oh, if I shoot it high, the ball doesn't get there. So I'm going to shoot it flatter. And in order for me to shoot it flatter, I need to lower my set point to compensate for my lack of physical strength. And this is a bit of, we're going to talk about this probably a couple of times in this episode. There's a bit of a chicken and the egg to this. Like, does the low set point, is that the chicken or... is the fact that we're going to come to it in the next topic again, and I'll revisit this, but there's always does this cause that or does that cause this? We'll never really know, but they are related.
So low set points, Dave, can we spend just 2 minutes talking? Yeah. I don't want to put any time on the thought clock. I don't want to put any pressure on you, but I want to talk about low set points. And frequent listener Mitch has sent me a number of texts that are videos about people with low set points. And especially right now in the social media sphere, there's a lot of conversation about low set points and generating power. For these guys that are pros, and some of them maybe play for teams that you are currently consulting for. He said, Steve Nash has a low set point and I disagree and yada, yada, yada. But anyway, these videos focus on set points where the elbow is really tucked and we're below the chin. Like, can we talk about that just for a couple of minutes, why that is a good or bad thing?
It's an effective thing for adding more power to longer shots. What does it do? It puts your body in a position where it has to make an uncomfortable choice. And the choice is, do I flatten out the shot? Which, if you're shooting from the logo and you're 210 pounds of muscle, you might not be that worried about. Or do I put the body in position where it has to twist to get underneath the basketball so that I can lift it? Those are really the two choices that you're left with when you have a low set point. Are you going to end up more on the back of the ball or on the side of the ball because you can't get underneath it? Or are you going to twist up your body and drop your right shoulder in order to get underneath it? And both of those solutions have their positives, but they also have major drawbacks. And then I think it's really important for players to understand, because I see this on social media, a low set point isn't a bad thing. Yeah, it is. We just have to understand what our definition of a low set point is. Is a low set point sort of just below the nose where a player can get their hand underneath the basketball? For Trae Young, that might be a low set point, and he's still reasonably effective with it. For Bobby, who's 9, a low set point is down around his chest. Those are not the same thing. And so when I'm talking about a young player with a low set point, I'm not talking about around their nose when I want it to be around their eyebrows and there's a 2-inch difference depending on the size of your nose. Very large nose here for teaching purposes only.
Same.
I'm talking about the 1-foot difference of young players being down here. That is a bad habit. That is putting you out of position to be able to shoot. And so it's just like the whole one motion, two motion argument. There's advantages to both. There's disadvantages to both. And then there's also a misunderstanding of what we mean, because different people have different definitions of what a one motion or two motion shooter is.
Can you give sort of, let you get a drink there. Can you give a paragraph on what you think one motion shooting and a paragraph on what you think two motion shooting is? And that's what I'm going to use as my definitions moving forward.
Honestly, I don't even know which one I reference anymore, because I talk to so many people that have different definitions. And so the first thing I'll do is clarify, what do you mean by one motion or two motion? Some people think a one motion shot is a ball that never stops moving, that is moving at a constant speed, similar to Steph Curry. Whereas a two motion shot is a lift to your set points, pause, and release. That's some people's definition of one motion or two motion. Other people say that, okay, one motion is more of a straight line and a two motion is an S curve. And the more significant the S curve, the more they're two motion. Well, those can be related or those can be mutually exclusive. And which we name which, I don't think really matters that much as long as we know which one we're talking about. But I can't be talking about the first one motion shot. And I'm saying, actually, there's a lot of evidence that would suggest that's not the best way for a mature athlete to do it. And you're talking about the second one motion shot. And we think we're disagreeing when we're actually agreeing, or vice versa. Like, we just have to be really clear about that and the low set point that we were talking about earlier.
So let's put a pin in the S-curve discussion, because you have some really fun things to talk about in that sphere in the future. But let's put a pin in that as like a fun tease. So let's get back to low set points just for a minute. Can be advantageous, but also comes with significant drawbacks. That's kind of the Coles notes of what you're saying.
Yeah. It can be advantageous in certain situations. Like, it can help you add distance if you are a valuable enough shooter, like that a longer shot becomes more valuable. For example, like, but it's going to sacrifice potentially some arc in order to do it. It's going to put you in a position where that shot is more easily blocked by a defender, and it puts you in a position where you might not be able to get your hand underneath the basketball. It ends up more on the side of the basketball, and you end up with, as you refer to it, thumb flick city. which I'd never heard before, but cracked me up at the time. And so those are some of the possible drawbacks, and we just need to be aware of those.
Let's take a quick break, and we can come back with a little bit more after this.
Hey there, basketball fans. Coach Dave Love here with an exciting opportunity to revolutionize your shooting game. Introducing my exclusive shot development systems, Pure Release, Consistency and Balance, and Fluidity and Arc. Each system is designed to target key aspects of your shooting technique, transforming you into a more effective player on the court. Pure Release focuses on perfecting your shot release. Consistency and Balance enhances your stability and accuracy, and Fluidity and Arc works on your ball path and trajectory of your shot. Find out the drills and progressions that I use with my NBA players to improve these important habits. Can't decide which one to choose? No worries, grab the bundle and get all three systems at a fantastic value. It's a complete package to elevate every part of your shooting game. And there's a special deal for all my podcast listeners. Use the promo code PODCAST20 at checkout to save 20% on any of the shot development systems. Don't miss this chance to train like the pros. Visit CoachDaveLove.com/store and take your first step towards shooting success. That's CoachDaveLove.com/store.
All right, Coach Dave, welcome back. Going to put up 24 seconds on the thought clock. We did our ATO. We drew it up. Tell me what we just, give me a concise version of what we did in the last little segment.
I think it's really important that coaches understand that not all low set points are the same. And when we're talking about a low set point being around the player's nose, I'm fine with, not totally fine with it, but I'm accepting of that. If we're talking about a low set point for a young player down around their chest, that's not the same thing as Trae Young's low set point. Down around your chest is going to put you out of position. And we've got to learn, as the player gets older and stronger, to get that set point hopefully up where Trae Young's low set point is, and then hopefully, as they continue to get stronger, higher than that as well.
That's the clip. Crushed it. That's a put two on the board for Coach Dave. That's great. Can we get into a couple of solutions or like suggestions on how we might fix these flat shots? Can we talk about that just for a few minutes?
Let's go through, because they all kind of come down to the set point. And my solution for a lot of these is kind of the same thing, because they're all out of position at the set point. We need to learn a more advantageous, a more optimal set point. So I feel like the solutions for a lot of them are going to be the same thing, and we can kind of go through them all at the end. But if you're okay with it, can I go into like the second most common cause of a flat shot?
Yeah, we can do that. I'm okay with that.
how about now? Do you want to do that now?
Okay.
All right.
Please.
Cool. Me too. So, second most common cause of don't encourage me.
Don't give thank you. I'll take a sub coach. That's
second most common cause of a low set point is, or a low shot, flat shot, is they get to the good set point, but they just don't lift out of it. And this was common of the player that I remember the most doing this is Dwight Howard, that he had one of the flatter shots that I've seen. He ended up at a pretty good set point where his hand was underneath the basketball and his elbow was low enough to still be able to lift. The problem is he just didn't lift. So he ended up in a great position, upper arm parallel to the floor, and then that elbow just stayed fixed and his hand was moving almost entirely forward, very, very small amounts of up. And if we go back to the initial, the overarching cause of this is as you're pushing the ball forward, just before your release, what happens? Your hand ends up more on the back of the basketball. And that pushes the ball forward. We need to be lifting the ball up so that your hand stays underneath the basketball, which is what pushes the ball upward. And so players end up, again, just to recap, with a flat shot because they hit a good set point, but they just push forward, not up out of that set point.
That example gives me a much better visual in my head when you talk about the billiards example, like your arm traveling around the fixed point of your elbow, creating a flat. I have a much better, just for what it's worth, I have a much better visual image when you gave that example than when you gave it in the first cause. So thanks for that.
Awesome. Awesome. So then number three, the third, in my opinion, most common, and I'm not like, there's no evidence. I'm just going off the top of my head. 1, 2, 3. It may be 1, 3, 2. I don't tweet me with, I would actually suggest that the third most common is the second most common. Yeah.
Please, you might be right. Please tweet him. No, just
kidding. Yeah, I'm going to send all these to Matt's new Twitter, which we're going to talk about these. So third, in my opinion, most common reason for a flat shot or cause of a flat shot is players they miss their set point, this time going back over top of their head. Mm. And this same sort of principle as we just talked about, kind of in the opposite direction, where now your elbow is already elevated. The ball has gone back over top of your head, and your elbow, instead of being upper arm parallel to the floor, is probably more on a 45-degree angle. And your elbow has no room to lift anymore. So the problem is you haven't actually begun the shooting motion. So I divide the shot up into two different motions, a lifting motion and then a shooting motion. And the transition point in between those two things is what I call the set point. Your set point is too high. Your elbow ends up elevated. And now you're starting the shooting motion with no room to lift your elbow. Now, the nice thing is, as you're lifting out of this position, so everybody that's listening, just even if you're in your car, pull over and put the ball back behind your head, a la Kevin McHale or Kevin Garnett. I think you have to be named Kevin to really do this at the NBA level. Bring the back ball behind your head and see how your elbow is already probably over top of your eye level. Try and lift your elbow higher. You probably don't have a lot of wiggle. You can probably get it another inch or two higher. If you imagine starting the shooting motion now, you begin that by lifting up, which is fantastic because we want the ball going up. And then even better, a half second later, the ball is moving up and forward, which is great. I want the ball going up and forward. But then a split second after that, the ball starts moving significantly forward. And so you have, as a shooter, have to release in that window where the ball is going up and forward to get the ball going in the correct direction and with the correct amount of arc. If you release it early, it's probably going too much up. And if you release it late, it's probably going too much forward. Almost all of these players that get the ball back over top of their head have what we're referring to as a curving ball path in the shot metric stuff that we're doing. And curving ball paths are shown to make distance control hard. We want to avoid the ball going back over top of the head. We want to hit a set point where the ball is in front of our forehead so that you still have room to lift your elbow to generate power. And we've got three joints, the shoulder, the elbow, and the wrist, all working towards getting the ball to travel in a straight line out of the set point. And when it's a straight line, if I release early or late, doesn't matter. The ball is always going in the same direction. So there's a lot to unpack there, but that's like those habits are one that I really try and work to avoid.
That's the 2 and 3 are similar in that it makes me think that you're rotating around a fixed point of your elbow. But that third one, you actually have a shot at generating some arc, especially if you're releasing early from that situation. Can you give me can you describe for the layman what you mean by a curving ball path? And I don't want to get sidetracked too far down that, but just you referenced it. I just want to explain it.
So
really
if you imagine being the shooting coach standing on the free throw line extended on the shooting hand side of a player shooting a free throw, you're seeing the right side profile of a right-handed shooter. Once they get to their set point, if you imagine the path that the ball takes out of that set point from that perspective, we want that line to be as straight a line as possible. And that's really hard to see with the naked eye, just like we've talked about the spin of the ball. It's really hard to see with the naked eye. But there are certain habits that we've now measured to see, oh, when you do this kind of thing, that tends to call more of a curving ball path, cause more of a curving ball path. And when you do that sort of thing, it also causes. And the more ideal, the more optimal motion is to try and keep a set point in front of you and lifting out the in a straight line.
So straight ball path is moving straight out from the release. Curving ball path is anything else where it's not moving in a straight line up and out and towards the hoop. It has some curvature before release.
Yep.
Or during the release. Okay, cool. So those are, in your opinion, the three most common causes of flat shots, which lead to short misses.
Right. And then there are other things that kind of become caused by those causes. There are other parts of your shot that are impacted by those mistakes. And so though, like having a set point back over your top or your head can affect your body posture and can put you in a position where you're the momentum of the ball has pulled your shoulders behind your hips and now you're off balance backwards. And these tend to be the players that they'll shoot a shot and then immediately throw their hands back behind them and step backwards out of that shot. They're not able to maintain vertical or forward energy at the end of the shot. They're leaning back. And in my opinion, it starts with, or what's playing a major role in that flaw is the set point.
Whoa. So all of that starts right here for a lot of those players.
I'd be careful with the word starts.
Okay.
But potentially that the set point will play a role at the very least. And that it may not be the start of the problem, but it may be a part of the problem.
Do you want to take a quick break and we'll get into some of these fixes?
Let's do that right now.
Hey basketball fans, Coach Dave Love here with an exclusive offer just for you, my personalized video shot analysis. Imagine having an NBA shooting coach analyze your shooting form, just like I do for the pros. That's exactly what you'll get with my video shot analysis. Here's how it works. You send me a video of your shot and I'll break it down frame by frame. I'll pinpoint your strengths and identify the areas of improvement and give you tailored advice to take your shot to the next level. You'll receive a comprehensive analysis designed just for you. Whether you're a beginner or an aspiring pro, my feedback will help you shoot with confidence and precision. It isn't just feedback, it's a game changer. With my video shot analysis, you're not just practicing, you're evolving, and every single shot counts. Ready to transform your game? Visit CoachDaveLove.com/store to learn more and get started. That's CoachDaveLove.com/store and look for video shot analysis.
Welcome back. Coach Dave. After this quick timeout, we're down two. I just drew up a really, really, really good play for you. I'm going to put 24 up on the thought clock. Give me the concise look at what we just talked about.
Be careful of the location of your set point, that we don't want the ball going back over top of our head, because that can cause inconsistent arc, of which one of the ways it could be consistent is you can be flat. And then make sure that once we hit the good set point that is more in front of your forehead and over top of your nose, that we're lifting out of that position. Otherwise, we're going to be pushing forward, causing that flat shot that we're trying to avoid.
So I'm going to have a super quick tangent here something I just realized. Coach, one of the reasons you struggle to be concise, and you were very concise just there, but you corrected yourself midway through because you felt the need to be precise. And I think your need for precision is sometimes the enemy of conciseness, and that's okay. And the precision is what makes you good at your job. So I'm okay with that. Does that make sense?
What did I say that I corrected myself on? Like I've forgotten already even what I said.
Same, but you stopped and clarified. You stopped at the point and clarified mid-sentence. And if you go back and listen, you'll see that moment. It's the need for precision that is the enemy of conciseness, and that's okay. I'm cool with it. I'm into it.
And as much as I feel, I appreciate you saying that. I take that as a compliment because I think you intended it as a compliment. Pretty sure. You're a nice guy. But as much as I try to be precise, I also try not to be inaccurate. And those can be two different things at times where I want to avoid saying something that isn't totally true. And so I think, I can't remember what I said exactly, but I think I probably caught myself saying something in definitive terms that has a little bit more wiggle room than I was presenting it to have. And that's something I find myself doing a lot, where I'll say something definitively, but then realize, well, okay, no, that is a gray area thing, and I need to phrase that a little bit more carefully.
So let me change precision to correctness. But it's, even still, I appreciate it, because I'd rather have a little wiggle room in places where there's wiggle room than you give a definitive answer. And me as a coach be like, well, Coach Dave said this has to be the way it is all the time. You know what I mean? So I do appreciate that.
And thank you for saying that, because ultimately, I think where we begin as coaches is with wanting black and white answers. and then the last thing I want is for people to leave listening to this podcast and think that I've said something as black and white when I intended it to be. No, just understand the gray area. And I think that's where we all kind of move towards with more experience, is the understanding of when the black answer might be more correct and when the white answer might be more effective, and how to play with those things and not get hung up on correct or incorrect.
It's funny, working in finance, the answer is often, it depends. You know, people ask a question, and how much money do I need to retire? And it really depends. Do you want to live on a yacht? Do you want to live in a broken down apartment? Like, those are two vastly different things. And a lot of your job, when people send you stuff on Instagram and Twitter, you know, give me a definitive answer for this. And you say, well, it really depends. Again, Thumbflick City is a perfect example. You know what I mean?
Yeah. In my world, I'm learning the appreciation of that from skill acquisition people, who I'll go to for a definitive answer. And often their reply is, well, did it work? Well, if it worked, then it worked. Yeah, sure. But tell me the right thing to do. Well, no, there is no right thing to do. There's just sometimes more beneficial things and sometimes less beneficial. Well, that's not the answer I want. I want you to tell me. and so I'm now back to being a newbie in this world and resisting the urge to want black and white answers and understanding the gray area.
What we both know, though, is the answer is never form shooting. Just kidding. Coach Dave, okay, I've derailed this for too long here. Let's get back to some of the correction for these causes of flat shots. So the first one that you said, hand on the back of the ball at the set point. Give us like a three paragraph or a two paragraph. What kind of methods do you use to help solve these problems?
Ultimately, I'm going to handle this a little bit differently. I'm going to give you all three kind of at once because they'd all kind of be the same. You, cheers. All three of these people are missing the set point in some way. And so I've got to teach you where the more optimal set point is. And so I would start with something like isolation drill where the ball is held up just above their nose, forehead height, where your hand is underneath the ball, but slightly towards the back so that we can push the ball up and forward. Like basically put the pool cue behind the center of the basketball. And so that I can push through the middle of the cue ball in the direction that I want the cue ball to go. Like, and that's essentially what I'm doing with isolation drills, teaching you where that point is. We're effectively doing that thing that pool or billiards players will do where we're like, okay, here, I want it to hit here, 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 here. And then there's my shot. I don't know how to explain what I just did for the people that are listening on the, when they're moving the cue back and forth along their finger, just behind the ball, I'm essentially doing that same thing with isolation drill, where I'm saying, here's where we need to be. And then leading them through the progression of ABC and slow to quick to say ABC now, learn how to find that position. And then slow to quick is learn how to find that position without stopping it. And so that's with, I'm not kidding, 90% of players, the initial progression that I'll go through, there's a variety of different ways that players screw that up. And we're just talking flat shots and we got three different reasons. And we could, if we include the legs thing, then we can say, okay, we got four different, ways that they can screw up a flat shot. Okay. Isolation drill, ABC, slow to quick. That progression is going to help me, help you feel the correct solution for all four of those things. If you're missing left, you're missing right. Same sort of thing. The solution is for me is often going to be a progression of those three drills and then adding variability, and game representativeness as I get better. Or as the player gets more familiar with those positions.
For frequent listeners, Coach Dave references these three drills all the time, but I think the magic lives in how you present it to each player in a way that works for them. And I want you to tell a story that you may have told in this pod already, the Wesley Owundu, your Wesley Owundu external cue story, because that is problem number three, and it was perfect for him. You found the sweet spot for him. Can you tell that story really quick? I really like that one.
So perfect. Thank you for leading me into this. You're a great teammate. So Wesley Owundu used to play for the Orlando Magic, and he brought the ball slightly back over top of his head. Not significantly necessarily, but slightly. And we were working to keep the set point more in front of his forehead. And so we started with isolation drill and ABC to kind of learn what that felt like. And somewhere in that process, I started to give him starting with my external cue, the one that made sense in my brain, after the internal explanation. I give him the external cue. I want you to keep the ball more in front of you. I want you to feel like you're pressing your nose a bit against a pane of glass, but the ball is on the other side of the glass. Your basketball can't break the glass. You can't bring the ball over top of your head. You will shatter the glass. Okay. And he did that pretty well. And so I immediately circled back and asked him, how did you do that better? And his response was, I didn't imagine a pane of glass. I pictured a force field that pushed the ball away. So as soon as I wanted, the closer I got to that force field, the more it was pushing the ball away. And I thought that was such a great explanation of a great explanation of his thinking in an external cue.
Like thank you for that. I do really love that story. And anytime that you've told me a story previously that I think pertains, I'm going to ask you to tell it, A, because I love Please. Hearing you tell the stories, but also I think it's useful for teaching moments for coaches. And one of the things I've learned through our 15 episodes is anytime we're able to use our relationship, our knowledge of a player to better teach that player, it's a win, right? Like, it's easier to teach a player that we have a good relationship with and understanding with, somebody that I kind of know how they think. It's going to be easier for me to teach that player in a way that makes sense to them. So even though we use your three drill progression here, like you said, in 90% of cases, you're approaching it differently on a player-to-player basis. And that is where the magic lives, really, truly.
Thank you for joining us on today's episode of the Coach Dave Love Podcast. To stay up to date with our future episodes, please remember to hit the subscribe button on your favorite podcast platform. Don't forget to sign up for Coach Love's free shooting newsletter on CoachDaveLove.com and be sure to follow him on social media. You can find him at Coach Dave Love.